Today, our topic is when the doctor becomes the patient. It's my pleasure to introduce Adrian Warnock. We've known each other for almost 30 years, I think. I first met when Adrian was a medical student and I was working with Christian Medical Fellowship and Student Ministry. And he became the editor of our student journal way back then. And it was the start of a huge amount of writing for Adrian. He's a medical doctor. He trained as a psychiatrist, worked in psychiatry in the National Health Service in the UK for 8 years. And he then worked in the pharmaceutical industry for another 15 years, helping to run the kind of clinical trials that bring us new medicines and communicate the results as well. He was diagnosed with blood cancer in May 2017, and he'll talk a little bit about that and lessons learned from it. Adrian's a published author. He's written a very good book on the resurrection and several others. And he's the founder of Blood Cancer Uncensored and has written a Christian blog, very popular blog since 2003, that you can access at Patheos. And Adrian is passionate, as you'll see, about learning and how to approach suffering with hope and with compassion. So a real pleasure to have you today, Adrian, on ICMDA webinars. Over to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, and I've obviously got very many fond memories of the years that I spent working with Peter as a medical student. And of course, you never really sort of feel like you grow up, do you? I mean, my mother once said that men never grow up. I don't know if that's true. But certainly, I think for me, there's a number of things that I want to sort of think about as we go through this. And I think one of the things that perhaps I hope you take away from this, if nothing else, is the realization that when, and it will be when something like this happens to you, and it may be 20 years, it may be 30 years time, but when something like this happens to you, that it won't be a shock. Because if I'm honest, it was a shock to me in many ways, but it shouldn't have been. And I guess it will always be a shock to some extent, because it's one thing to think you know what might be coming. It's another thing to realize it's here. A rather negative view of life is to say that life is suffering, and that if you stay around long enough, you will find suffering comes your way. But often, in a weird sort of way, we feel a little bit alienated from it. We feel a little bit separate from it. And that's partly a defense mechanism, I believe. But of course, one of the reasons is precisely what I was just talking about, really, that we feel young. And so my first little point here is just this, that young people don't get sick. And of course, when I got sick, I was actually 46. So perhaps some of you on the call might argue that I wasn't young then, but I certainly felt young. And in terms of the diagnosis that I got, I was quote, quote, too young to get that diagnosis. And I think that's one of the things that we sort of feel like we're still in the prime of our life. You know, we expect perhaps our elderly parents to become unwell. But actually, I had a major health concern before either of my parents really got sick at all, in any major way anyway. And so that can be a bit of a shock. But our expectations are perhaps wrong. And if you think back only just 50 or 100 years, perhaps, I don't think most people would have had those expectations. And perhaps in, you know, for some of you on the call today, even depending on where you are in the world and situation that you grew up in, maybe you didn't have those expectations. Maybe you faced significant suffering at a younger age. But I do think that, as Tim Keller once said, our current culture, certainly our Western culture anyway, and to the extent to which that culture often influences all around the world, is probably the most unprepared culture that exists for when suffering hits. And you might think that as a doctor, we would be somehow at an advantage. But I think, having spoken to many other doctors and nurses and other healthcare professionals who've been in a similar position, actually, if anything, it's almost harder. And we'll talk a bit more about that. So for me, it was a normal day. And I don't know if this is a familiar sight to some of you on this call or a very unfamiliar sight, but if you were to visit London, you would become rapidly familiar with this very helpful phrase, mind the gap. And of course, we can, you know, pretend that I've put that there to make some kind of spiritual point about the gap between your expectations and the reality. But actually, it's there just to say, mind the gap between the train and the platform. And that's the phrase that's said. But for me, I was sitting on a train that looked almost exactly like that, complete with a green pole that you hold on to when there's too many people on the train. And I got off at the station. On the way home from a normal day at work, I'd gone and I'd interviewed somebody who I was trying to hire. I'd done various other things at work, and I was on my way home, like I'd done many times before, actually quite close to where I studied, at Mile End tube station it was, and I needed to change tubes. And I stood up feeling normal. I got to the doorway here, and I stepped onto the platform, and as I did so, my leg buckled under me and I suddenly felt weak. I suddenly felt extremely breathless. In fact, at the time, I thought I was having an asthma attack. I noticed that my watch was telling me my heart rate was somewhere around 150, I think. And I felt very confused and muddle-headed. And I just thought, what is going on? And I stumbled along the platform, asked for some help, and was actually carried off that platform to the very hospital that I trained at, that I was at as a medical student when I first met Peter. And it's a very strange feeling to come into the hospital that you trained at as a patient. But to be honest, in that initial phase, I was not very with it. I didn't really know what was going on. That night, I was eventually seen. I was diagnosed with pneumonia on the basis of the signs on the chest in terms of what they could hear and on the x-ray. But they didn't think it was that bad. So they actually sent me home, but told me to come back to hospital, you know, safety netting, as they call it, if I didn't rapidly respond to the oral antibiotics they gave me. And I didn't. So within a day or two, I was back. And then I had the phone call that really changed my life. Although that moment for me is, for those of you who might have watched the movie Sliding Doors, it feels like a Sliding Doors moment, that moment of stepping onto the platform. My old life ended on that. At that moment, and I've never been well since. I've been a sick person rather than a doctor since that time. I've been a patient, and it's been an interesting word to own that you are now the patient. And I got a phone call, and the phone call was from a hematologist at the first hospital that I had gone to. And she just quite casually over the phone said that I needed to come and see her urgently. Because she'd looked at my blood under the microscope and was almost certain that I had leukemia. And of course, you hear the word leukemia or blood cancer, and that's all you know. And one of the funny things, of course, is that people sometimes treat you a little bit different when they hear that you're a doctor. And they say something like, but of course you understand that. And I felt like saying, hey, you know, any hematology I ever knew would have probably been from one lecture. And one lecture, as Peter said, 30 years ago. So anything I knew would have been wrong anyway. And so it was a very shocking moment. And the thing that you notice most is those that have compassion, those that don't. There was a very compassionate nurse who tried her best to help me on a very busy ward where she was almost alone looking after several patients. And when I begged her to try and call the local hematologist to come and talk to me and explain what was going on, and maybe a nurse or somebody who knew something about this stuff, she was very happy to do so, but that doctor was not forthcoming. And so one of my first experiences was being left for actually a couple of weeks or more, I can't remember the exact amount of time, not able to get that semi-confirmed diagnosis confirmed, and struggling with a infection that just wouldn't go away, because of course I was immune compromised. Eventually, I ended up being transferred, and it's a long story I won't go into now how that happened, but I ended up being transferred to a more specialist hospital where they treated me as immune compromised and frankly saved my life, because by the time I got there, I was beginning to go into sepsis. And I was told, oh, you'll get better. It's fine. You know, the only reason you're weak and feel a bit tired and confused is because of the pneumonia, and your blood cancer is early. It doesn't need treatment yet. It's slow growing. All of these reassuring things. You may not need treatment for 10 years. And don't worry, listen to your body. And before you know it, you'll be back on your feet and well again. Well, on April the 28th of this year, it'll be 4 years since the moment I stepped off that tube, and I haven't felt well since. I managed to do small amounts of work in the first few months, but I never got back to full speed, and I probably never will. So I had the pneumonia I mentioned. I was diagnosed with the leukemia. I was then developed, because the sort of leukemia I had is something called CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia. It's actually a subtype of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. So I often say it's a blood cancer that can't decide whether it wants to be a leukemia or a lymphoma. And so at one point it decided to try and choke me in my throat by making my tonsils become grade four and meet in the middle, and I was losing my airway. So I had to be admitted as an emergency again. So that was another admission, not quite as long as the first. Had to have an emergency operation, then had to have another operation as the lymphoma grew further down my throat. But at that point, it was still watch and wait, but chemotherapy would follow a few months later. And that's an experience which perhaps I could go into. But the crucial thing, I suppose, along all of these experiences, what it's like to be a patient, to be on the ward, to be part of that routine that actually often doctors forget, because they're in and out of the wards. So they don't necessarily see what it's like to be there in the morning, to try and get in that shower before anyone else does, and before people start coming to visit, or the doctors start doing their rounds, to worry if the phlebotomist is going to remember to take your blood or not, to wonder what the results are for half the day until someone tells you, to actually have many hours of sheer boredom and not knowing what's going on, and all of that. It can feel very slow moving, actually, when you're on a ward, even in an NHS which is eager to get people out as quickly as possible. The confusing comments from different doctors. One thing I noticed that's changed since my day, because it's been a while since I've been an inpatient, is the fact that each day you saw a different doctor. So there was no continuity of care. You're explaining yourself again and again, going through the story over and over again, and a traumatic story at that. And the decisions were sometimes delayed until the next doctor came in. And certainly with that tonsil lymphoma, it was very much like that. But you noticed as well a difference between, and I'll come back to this in a minute, between some doctors and nurses who were perfectly competent and you had faith in their competence, but there was something lacking, and others which had a more human touch. And I'll talk a bit more about what that really is, and how as Christians perhaps we can hope to cling on to that as a vital thing that can make a huge difference to our patients. And then, of course, after the chemotherapy, I haven't written on this list the sort of dysfunction to my immune system. I'm on immunotherapy at the moment, antibody replacement therapy. I've also been in a study to take antibodies for COVID. So I've got some monoclonal antibodies in my body for that, hopefully to try and protect me. But all of that, and then also autonomic dysfunction that apparently probably happened in that initial pneumonia and has led me to really struggling with fatigue, inability to stand, and all sorts of things. I can't work, I've lost my career. And there's a huge sense of loss, actually. I think that's one thing that we forget. It's very easy to just, you know, go through the motions of telling a patient some bad news again, but forget that whilst it might be the, you know, 100th time you've given that sort of news, it's the first time they've heard it for themselves, and it changes everything. And there are some things that you can do in the approach to that situation that make all the difference as people think back and remember those moments. And obviously fatigue is a big part of the story. So this was my room with a view. In UCLH, which wasn't the hospital I trained at, I spent many a week in here looking out over London, trying to tell myself that it was like having a penthouse suite that I didn't have to pay for. But it's quite a lonely experience as well. And that was before COVID. I ended up needing a Zimmer frame or a walker. I don't know what you call that in different parts of the world. That was a shock as a young person. And really, in that moment, when they brought the Zimmer frame in, I suddenly felt about 90. And I thought, what's happened to my life? Am I retired now? Is that the end? But of course, it's not the end. But there is a loss of certainty. The dreaded C word, as I've already mentioned, is a big shock for people. The loss of your career, being unable to work sometimes, can be very hard for a doctor. The relationships, I mean, it's one of the hardest things, because the first thing people say to you is often, how are you? And someone said it to me on the call at the moment. And you're tempted to be honest and say, actually, I feel dreadful, and I've felt dreadful for 4 years. But that's not the best way to start a conversation. Let's be honest, most people don't really want to know that, and it's not particularly encouraging. So you find ways of not lying by saying you're okay. You say something like, oh, not too bad, or pretty good for me, I think was what I said today to the team as we came on the call. But then, of course, the second question that they ask, if it's a new friend or even if it's an old friend, they'll ask you about it, is what do you do? What's your work? And so that can be very difficult as well. It can have a massive impact on your relationship. And hope. And hope is crucial. And it's interesting that, you know, we can offer hope or we can take hope away sometimes in the way we communicate. And I've heard some dreadful stories about people who were given no hope at the time of their diagnosis, and even their treatment was just basically told there was no hope for them. But actually, it turned out there was hope, and they got treated and they did better than they thought they were going to do. So it's probably never a good idea to take away hope, even in the sort of temporal sense, even in the illness sense, because that can be really hard. And sometimes you might think you've given someone hope, but you may not have actually communicated the real hope that they need. It's an interesting thing. You can say something, but what's received at the other end of the bed or the other side of the desk might be a slightly different message from what you intended to give. And of course, I mentioned earlier, but young people don't get sick, but also, you know, Christians don't get sick, or at least in some people's theology. And of course, most of us, I suspect, on this call wouldn't actually believe this. And yet there's a sort of hint, it's almost like we do a bit of a deal with God. You know, if I'm a good Christian, if I read my Bible, if I go to church, if I attend Christian medical fellowship or association type things, if I maybe even do a bit of evangelism or perhaps help with some leadership, if I give, if I pray, if I read my Bible, all of these things, then God will kind of look after me. And sometimes without necessarily going all the way down that route of what you might call the sort of prosperity gospel or the health and wealth gospel, we can sort of go a little way along that. And there's even verses that people use to quote. I've heard this one quite a lot recently in the context of COVID-19. Nor will any plague come near your tent. You know, God is going to keep me safe. I won't get sick. Well, of course, that wasn't true for me. And that's not what Jesus said. So Jesus actually said, I've told you these things that you might have peace. And of course, peace is another Christian gift, if you like, that goes as a brother or a sister to hope, I suppose. But Jesus said this: in this world you will have trouble. And how many people know that Jesus always keeps his promises? This is a promise: in this world you will have trouble. And it's very important, as I said at the beginning of the talk, that you remember that these are the words of Jesus. You're either in the middle of trouble now, you're coming out of a trouble, or at some point in the future, you will be going into a trouble, and perhaps you're in a break between troubles now. Each day, Jesus said elsewhere, has enough trouble of its own. But he also said this: take heart, I have overcome the world. And having Jesus with you, a sense of Jesus with you in your trouble, doesn't take away all the pain. It doesn't take away all the sorrow. It doesn't take away the despair at times and the challenge and the emotions, the strong emotions. But it does give us hope. And for me, the question I had to ask myself is, do I really believe this stuff? I was a published author at that point. I'd been a blogger. I'd preached sermons. But do I really believe it? Or is it just my parents' faith, or is it just a faith that I've never really questioned? And we spoke about hope, and yes, hope for this life is important, but the hope that really gives you strength is the hope, not just for this life, but the hope for eternity. Because if actually our hope is only that God will look after us in this world, in this life, then as Paul said, then really we're of all men most miserable, because actually, sooner or later, trouble's going to hit. And people will say, so where is your God now? Where's your faith now? A bit like what Satan said of Job. You know, if that happens to Job, will God still receive worship and honor from him? And this is not a simple decision. It's not a thing of a moment. I spoke to a pastor who had brain cancer, and he talked about that famous verse about casting all your anxiety onto Jesus because he cares for you. And he said, you might have to do that 10 times a day or more. It's a process. It's a journey. And my favorite book on this subject is Tim Keller's book on suffering. And he talks about it being a journey and a process and a walk. And sometimes we expect an instant solution as Christians. We think, oh, well, yes, God is with me. All I need to do is put on that fake Christian smile and I'll be fine. And I can tell you it's not like that. Not when you face the prospect of your own mortality and your own frailty. So actually, as part of a process where I honestly wonder if you're going to lose your faith at some points. And I actually picked up my own book, a book about the gospel that I wrote with my pastor, Topi Colioso, and this book, Hope Reborn, really a very basic book. But I realized that actually that basic truth was the only thing that was going to give me hope. I would listen to gospel music that helped to teach me, again, the basics. I would try and just get back to that position of knowing that Jesus loved me because the Bible tells me so, that Jesus loved me because he died for me, that Jesus loves me because he was risen again for me, and that Jesus loves me because he's preparing a home for me in heaven, and that my real hope is not that my cancer is cured, although it would be wonderful if it was, is not that my fatigue would disappear, although it would be wonderful if it was, is not that my immune system would somehow miraculously get better, although of course it would be wonderful if it did, but my real hope should be, needs to be, is it? In Jesus and the eternity that he's preparing for me. But doctors don't get sick. And of course, you find that some people are shocked. I remember it's not uncommon, actually. I get picked up by hospital transport and it does say on my notes that I'm Dr. Adrian Warnock. And they get very confused that the patient transport port is taking a doctor in. And you do find that a little bit. How can a doctor be sick? And I think part of that is this. I talk about compassion. And this is the critical thing that as a doctor, as I draw towards a conclusion of this little talk, is this word compassion. It's a really important word. It's a word we don't use much in our professional lives, I think. It's a word that we can sometimes feel there's a fatigue that comes in, that if you have too much compassion, it can be difficult. We need to be professional. There's that sense of us and them, and it can almost divide you as a doctor from the patients in order to protect yourself and to maintain that calmness in a crisis, because you do need to be objective. Not too emotional, and you need to protect yourself and to be this word dispassionate. And yet Jesus, it says, was compassionate and looked on the people as like sheep without a shepherd. And what is compassion? Well, the Merriam-Webster dictionary calls compassion the sympathetic consciousness or awareness of others' distress together with a desire to alleviate it. And I think that's a critical thing. You see, some doctors and nurses seem to instinctively know that their patients are finding it really hard. Even if their patients don't tell them that, they are finding it really hard. And so there's just the little things that you do that recognize that and try and alleviate that suffering, whether it's making sure that instead of writing the paracetamol or the acetaminophen or whatever you call it in your countries, because I know it's different names, on the PRN side or the as requested side, you put it on the regular side so that the nurses don't have to have the bell rung to go and give you pain relief. You know, I mean, this is one of the hugest issues. It sounds silly, it sounds basic, but it's so much easier if you get your pain relief regularly rather than when you request it on a busy ward, especially. So compassion is when love, and we as Christians are taught to love even our enemies and certainly our patients, but when love moves beyond mere emotion and motivates us to action. Medicine should never become merely a career where our reason to work is either simply to earn money or just to get through the day. Let's be honest, it can be very hard. And I don't want to downplay how difficult it is, because I remember being on call. I remember the 1 in 4 rotas. I remember the nights and the weekends on call and the real challenges. And we do have to protect ourselves. We do have to, however, cling on to compassion. And I like this from the Telegraph. I don't believe this was a Christian, but I think he expresses it well. Doctors have to be compassionate and dispassionate at the same time, because a doctor who was completely indifferent to the sufferings of others, well, actually, they'd be a public menace. But a doctor who felt every patient's suffering as though it was his own or his own family member would obviously have a very short and miserable career. So there's a sort of tightrope to walk here. And I'm not suggesting that you spend half an hour with each patient giving them counseling and all of that. I'm just saying there's an attitude that you have. It's like a switch in your brain that stops seeing them as them, but as us. And another doctor who got sick put it this way, that hand squeeze, that compassionate look, the acknowledgement of the person inside, 2 minutes to listen, it can all make the difference. And the patient might feel peaceful, hopeful, valued, warm inside. Just remember, one day you could be the patient sitting in that bed or sitting on the other side of your desk. And as Jesus put it, do to others what you would have them do to you if you were that patient. Okay, there we go. That's me done.
Thank you, Adrian, for your courage and your honesty and openness and also your clarity in sharing your testimony and some of the lessons that you've learned from it. So we're going to move into a time of question and answer now. So Adrian, let's move on to the questions, and they've been coming in. First of all, question from Marissa Rizalta, who is from the Philippines, and she's asking, what coping mechanisms or adjustments did you adopt in order to find joy and hope in the midst of your condition, and how were you able to process it? So,
Well, there's a whole nother talk on this, really, but we were always taught in psychiatry that, you know, your mental health is a biological, psychological, and social influence. And we would talk about the biopsychosocial model of mental illness, but also just of distress. And I think everybody who goes through something like I went through will have, you know, distress that at times might even look like it's a mental illness. But as a Christian, we'd obviously add the spiritual. And so for me, we often latch onto one or other of those things and think that's the solution. But I actually, you actually need to address all of those. So for me, you know, biologically, making sure you have enough sleep, actually, really crucial. And there are some basic things that you can do with sleep hygiene and all sorts of other things. Exercise where you can do it, although, of course, it can be quite difficult. But, you know, getting out into the forest and seeing God's creation, just on a physical level, quite apart from the fact that you may spiritually connect with him more in that moment, can be incredibly helpful. And I could spend a long time about that. And, you know, getting your medication right, pain relief, all of those things. Psychological, I would say I did take counselling, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. Some Christians wouldn't like to do that. I did that, and I went for counselling with someone who was a specialist in cancer rather than actually another believer, although obviously I did talk also to my pastors. And socially, that's a whole nother issue. Your relationships, I think, you know, sometimes I honestly think I made some mistakes in that area. And then spiritually, as I already mentioned, you know, looking at hope, looking at the gospel, listening to Christian music. Sometimes you can't really listen to a sermon, you can't really read a book, but you can usually listen to some quiet, reflective gospel music in the background. So those are some of the things. But I suppose the other thing I would say is there's a post I wrote called The Tyranny of the Positive. I think sometimes that can be a little bit you can be too positive, and perhaps we'll come on to that in one of the other questions I noticed we've got there.
From Tim Tusink, American doctor working in Africa, training GPs. Thanks for sharing. He says, hope is such a vital part of life in general, and our faith in particular. And as you mentioned, can be easily taken away during medical or social encounters. What are your suggestions for hopeful phrases or words as we care for and encounter people who are suffering? Maybe a reflection too on what really helped you and perhaps what didn't. Sure. As well.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, hope's interesting because we can have a sort of false hope, and the Bible says that hope deferred makes the heart sick. So here's what you don't want to do, is just be relentlessly positive. I came out of hospital and a family member told me I could barely walk, that I needed to join a boot camp. And it was like a kind of peer leader type of sort of attitude, you know? And that's not helpful. Phrases like at least isn't helpful either. You know, so at least you've only got a slow growing cancer, for example. It's like, well, actually, what kind of mugger do you want? One with a knife or a gun? You know, it doesn't really make much difference. You've got a mugger, you know? And so those kind of phrases that minimize things or try and be sort of too positive can actually have an opposite effect, because it can feel very false and you can feel devalued. So I think for me, hope is about acknowledging the reality that you face. I mean, Abraham, it says, doesn't he, face the fact that his body was as good as dead. And it's then about a journey, and it's making sure that people can see there is hope, but it's a real hope and it's a realistic hope. And I think that's important. You have to be honest. There's nothing worse than the doctor who tries to tell you everything's fine when it really isn't. But equally, there's nothing worse than a doctor who says on the physical level, you know, who gives the impression that there's nothing that can be done and that there is no hope. So there's a fine balance, even on the physical side, and similarly spiritually, it's really, or psychologically, you know, it's really important to allow people the space to feel anxious, to feel afraid, to feel hopeless, actually, but then to have that journey of working through the thinking and the processing to actually come to that point of hope, which is a genuine hope, of sorrow in the midst of being tinged with joy, you know, of real despair at times, but not letting that completely remove your hope. So yeah, it's a journey, it's a process. And there were some days where I was crying into the pillow, feeling pretty hopeless, I'll be honest.
Now, you talked early on when you first went into hospital about it being a couple of weeks really before you had the information.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know what it's like on a busy ward. You just don't feel you have time to pause with people. But you seem to be implying that getting more accurate information earlier would really have helped you. Let's reflect on that. And if you were to practice again, how you might be different the way you practice yourself in terms of imparting information. What could help us be better doctors?
Yeah, I think... ideally not over the phone, which of course is very difficult at the moment. A lot of medicine's going on over the phone. I found it very hard hearing that over the phone. And one of the reasons not over phone is about the follow-up, you see. As a doctor, you're never going to be able to answer all the questions. So it's about making sure that either a nurse can go and sit with that person and talk to them, or that you can put them in contact perhaps with a patient organisation or some written information. Or even just give them another slot and say, look, you know, we can't talk about everything today, but we'll meet on such and such time and we can, and I'll try and answer all your questions there. Encourage the person to write down their questions, because often, you know, you have that 2 minutes and before you know it, you know, the appointment's over and you've not asked the real question that you were concerned about. And just making sure that people, I mean, there are some fantastic telephone helplines that you can refer people to. And I had no idea about patient charities and things for quite a long time. So those kinds of communication and making sure that there is some support structures in place for people after you've gone and dropped that bombshell, and doing it in a way that is human, really, and humane.
Another question from the audience. How did you respond to doctors caring for you who were rude or arrogant? Or dismissive?
Yeah, you just have to almost let it go over you. I mean, I remember one of the worst ones was a doctor coming with all these like people to my ward, and there'd been a lot of debate about what was going on with my tonsils as to whether it was tonsillitis or whether it was my chronic slow growing cancer in the tonsils, because they were growing quite quickly. And so I asked him, what did he think was going on? And he just looked at me and said, oh, I think it's a high-grade lymphoma. It's transformed, and walked away. It's like, thanks. But what can you do? There's nothing you can do in those circumstances, really, apart from maybe cry with the nurse later or your family member or whatever, or talk to God about it. I mean, it's certainly not a chance to sort of tell them off, that's for sure, much as you might be tempted to.
It's interesting your comment early on about being told you had leukemia and then that it was CLL and having probably an hour of on leukemias in total in your medical training 30 years ago, and people assuming you knew more than you did. Yeah. Do you think that in terms of handling medical patients patients who are doctors or who have are nurses or whatever, do you think we can assume too much? And what advice would you have?
Yeah, I assume nothing, unless, of course, they're a specialist in the disease. And that I have heard of that when someone, you know, gets the illness that they've been studying all those years. That's a little different. But if it's coming from a different specialty or a general practice specialty where, you know, you may not know the depths, don't assume they know and don't assume they're up to date. Obviously, over time, the chances are good that you're going to become pretty expert in the disease. You're going to read up about it. And there's a whole another thing, because it's very different reading a clinical paper as a patient, but that's a whole different subject. But assume they know nothing and just say, look, and be explicit with that and just say, look, I'm going to assume you don't know anything. I'm not trying to patronize me. Please stop me if I'm telling you things you already know or something. And people will appreciate that, actually. You just want to be treated like anyone else, really.
Adrian, ever since I've known you, you've always been very IT savvy. I remember you used to write a column for the CMF journal called CyberDoc in the early days of the internet. And I just wondered, in terms of getting information, did you go immediately and read up all about CLL and everything?
Yeah.
And how, did that compare with what you were told by others?
Initially, it was my only source of information because, for whatever reason, the local haematologist in the hospital I was an inpatient at refused to come and see me at all. You're sitting there on your phone, Googling stuff, coming up with patient charities, trying to read papers and things online, some of which are out of date and some of which say bald things like, oh, yes, life expectancy of 5 years. And unless you realize that's out of date because the treatment's gone, you know, you've gone on, you sort of get really sort of shocked. But actually, I think one of these forums saved my life because it was saying you need to get yourself to a specialist. And so I took some steps to get myself to a specialist hospital. And by the time I got there, I was beginning to develop sepsis, which had been missed. So yeah, I think if I hadn't have done that, I'm not 100% sure I'd be talking to you today. So I think it's important to not, and you have to take ownership of your own situation. It's quite shocking, actually, as a patient, how much admin you need to do. And how much you do need to try and understand what the different specialists are saying, especially if you end up being one of those complicated patients. I've seen so many different specialists and they know their individual bit, but they don't know the rest. And so you're the one trying to piece it together, hopefully with your GP, if you've got a good GP.
Did you find your illness had given you more opportunities to witness, share your faith to other patients, family, healthcare professionals? Any examples that you could share?
For me, actually, one of the things I realized was that one of the best opportunities is with other patients, whether that's face-to-face. Sometimes there's a patient lounge where people go and have a free coffee and you might talk to somebody there. And I've had some, you know, wonderful conversations there that it's like any other conversation. You don't start with your faith, but that may well come up as the conversation goes on. Or online in some of these patient forums. And in the end, I actually started my own website and forum because some of them are a little bit anti any conversation of faith whatsoever, unfortunately. So I created a space which I've called Blood Cancer Uncensored. And we have to allow, obviously, anyone from any faith or none to talk about what their experiences are. But it's quite interesting sometimes to talk to people who are facing, you know, their own mortality, because it has a way of making you think about all the things that you've used to value. And there are people that lose their Christian faith at a moment like that, but there are atheists who turn to God at a moment like that as well. So it's an interesting opportunity. And that's why I think, you know, the Blood Cancer Uncensored thing has given us an emerging community where Christians and non-Christians can interact together. And you see the hope, you can sort of tell who the people are who have a faith, or even if they're facing real difficulties and maybe struggling, may even be depressed. There's somehow a hope that never completely goes away. There's a flame flickering, hopefully. And I think that is, you know, it says in scriptures, you know, always be willing to give an answer to the hope that's within you. But also recognize at times you're going to feel rubbish, and it's okay to say that. And it's okay to just be the patient sometimes. You're not there always as the testimony, or, you know, you don't have to put on a fake smile. You can say, look, I'm really struggling. And even that can be actually a good testimony because you're being honest and you're not trying to pretend. Sorry about that.
Tell us a bit more about Blood Cancer Uncensored, yeah. the website, and the kind of conversations that go on there,
yes,
and what your feeling is about it.
Yeah, so it's a mixture. So we have a mixture of, you know, articles that are written, you know, that try and explain some of the science basically in a way that would help someone, you know, even another doctor actually, because it's just shocking sometimes when you're suddenly in a really stressed state trying to read a complicated article. So we have some of that, and then mixed in with it, we'll have talks about sort of psychological side, how we've coped with it, and then intermingled with that, some of the writers there will talk about their faith. So it's a sort of blog, it's a group blog, but we also have a Facebook group and a Zoom call actually that we have with people alongside that. And it's always from the beginning been a mixture of Christians and non-Christians, both in terms of the writers and also in terms of those reading and those sort of seeking some support and some mutual help. And it's an opportunity. And there's been a lady who made a recommitment and got baptized as a result of all of that. And another lady as well, who made a sort of more firm commitment to her faith. So I think sometimes, you know, we can reach out and just offer a little bit of hope to people. And you might see people who have some sort of Christian faith, at least in theory, but when you get challenged like this, I know for me, and I was by no means a sort of nominal Christian beforehand, but it really does shake you up a little bit, and you want to explore it a bit further, and you want to sort of dig it deeper, and you want to have some honest conversations with people at times.
And is the website, Adrian, open access? Can anyone go and read there?
Blood Cancer Uncensored is open access. And I've actually ended up writing quite a bit of stuff about COVID on there that might be of interest to people who aren't necessarily blood cancer patients. But obviously it's highly relevant for us because of the immune compromise. So there's a lot of material there. And then from that, there's obviously the Facebook page. And then within that, there's a Facebook group, which is then obviously specifically for people who have a blood cancer, or perhaps their loved one has a blood cancer. So it's sort of like a kind of onion rings, really. And then within that, there's a smaller group of people that meet each week on a Zoom call, about 10 or 15 of us. It's almost like a little small group, to be honest. We don't pray or read the Bible together at the moment because it's a mix of Christians and non-Christians, but we do talk about our faith and how it makes a difference at times in that context.
What's been the role of your church in this? How has your illness affected the church? How have they got around and supported you? What have you all learned together as a community in the experience?
It's a challenge, isn't it? I mean, you know, we're a large church. So, I mean, it's obviously no one person, you know, can be the focus of everything in a large church. And you don't want that either. I mean, that's one of the challenges is communication, actually, in the first place. And initially, I didn't want everyone to know. But at some point, you know, it was sort of spoken about, and that was, you know, very supportive. It can be a challenge, actually. I mean, for my wife, you know, she would go to church and almost every week someone would ask her, how's Adrian doing? But not always ask her how she was doing. And obviously you have your closer friends who reach out to you more. And it's interesting, actually, some of the friends that are there for you more than you would expect them to be, and some that are there for you less than you'd expect them to be. So there's an interesting sorting of friendships, and there were a few people that I'd sort of drifted apart from that I'd known as a younger man who immediately came visited me in hospital, and then others who I thought I was particularly close to perhaps I saw less of. But certainly my pastor has been very supportive, and some of my other sort of close Christian friends. And sometimes you need someone to be supportive and encouraging, and it's okay to feel rubbish and all of that, but then sometimes you need someone to sort of almost rebuke you as well, and knowing that wisdom is quite important. So I'm very blessed, particularly I think, to have the pastor that leads the church, Toppy, who's also a close friend of mine, and we wrote that book together, and he's certainly been in my face a few times when I've needed it, which has been wonderful.
Best kind of friends. So tell us about your family, because you've got several kids, Andre, yes, and wife, and how, what effect has it had on them, if you're able to share that with us?
They're not fully bought into sort of the public life like I am, so I need to be a little bit careful about that. And I think it's crucial, I suppose, to realise that they're each individuals. And so when I told them, I didn't gather them as a group, especially with five of them. I went through them, or we went through them individually, and I've tried to do that whenever there's been sort of updates and news. But that process of managing news, even for people that you're close to, it's sometimes possible to miss somebody out. I remember one time, one of my kids, I didn't tell a really important piece of good news to. I thought I had. I told all of the others. They hadn't told that one because they knew I liked to have it. And somehow I missed them out. I don't know how that happened. And they found out a month or so later and were really upset with me. So one of the things I learned actually is write down who you've told things to. You know, even in your own family, it sounds bizarre. But then, you know, if you had two kids, it probably wouldn't happen. But certainly with friends as well. Because I remember getting to a point where you couldn't remember who you told and who you hadn't. And that made for some weird conversations sometimes, you know, when you meet people. So, yeah. So, and I think for them, it's very easy as the patient to forget that it actually affects your family as well. You know, you're not the father that you once were. You don't have the energy. You mentioned about the church a minute ago. I've had to stop all the sort of leadership that I did. This is the closest thing I've come to giving a talk or, any kind of thing for a while. Though I think I did manage to do one thing for CMF once as well. But yeah, it's certainly not done very much at all in terms of speaking because I'm getting tired now, and so I'm glad it's nearly finished. But
minutes to go.
Yeah.
When's it, Adrian? You know, we believe in a God who can and does miraculously heal, and yet chooses not to, sometimes works through medicine, and we're balancing all these things. When is it right to pray for and expect a miracle?
Yeah, really? I think it's always right to pray for a miracle, and it's always right to hope for a miracle. I think the word expect is an interesting word because I'm not convinced that we're promised always that we'll get a miracle, and certainly didn't happen for Paul and the apostles because obviously they'd all be alive today if it did. And Paul talked about one time, you know, when one of his friends came close to death, you know, and all of those things. And so, you know, I think we have to be a bit honest about the now but not yet. And remember that actually, you know, the biggest miracle is what happens on the inside and also what happens when we die. You know, ultimately, we will be healed one day. And so that hope is difficult because, you see, I talked earlier about false hope, and sometimes you do have to sort of kind of almost get to the point of thinking, well, you know, unless something amazing happens, this is now my life, you know, and that's certainly where I'm at. But then you have that hope that there's a better day coming, and you know, and you're hoping for the powers of the age to come breaking through at times, and we certainly do see that. And, you know, one of the hard things is when you hear stories about other people getting miracles and you don't get one. It's like, well, you know, what's wrong with me? Is my faith not strong enough? Or did I commit some sin? Does God not love me as much as that person? Especially if you hear about, you know, oh yes, God gave me the miracle of a parking space or something. You sort of think, I could use some help here, God. But sometimes you have to be honest. And I've certainly prayed to God, why is it you don't seem to answer my prayers these days? And then, you know, gently, he sort of reminds me of a few things that he has answered my prayers for.
In some cultures, telling the truth to patients is considered heartless. In fact, in some instances, relatives prefer to know more about the patient than the patient themselves, and might even forbid you telling the patient. And some of us who are old enough to remember medicine in the West will remember a time when you didn't tell patients the truth. Perhaps we err on being absolutely barn door obvious open now more than we should. But what your reflections on that? How much is enough to both maintain hope, but also, you know, be real and honest with information that really belongs to the patient?
This is really, really difficult. And of course, you know, culture is a huge part to play in this. There are things that you might have to do in some cultures that would get you struck off in others, you know? So, you know, I think we have to be trying to move towards a situation wherever we live, though, where the individual patient is given autonomy and respect about information that is essentially their information. How you do that in a culturally sensitive way is difficult. And how you don't want to be brutal, especially if it's in a culture where this hasn't been the done thing. You know, some people, I think, almost take delight in taking the hope away and sort of basically leaving you with the not sure and certain knowledge that you're going to die and you're going to die very soon. And And I mean, I suppose it was a little bit like that when the guy just said to me, he was short, you know, he thought I'd got an aggressive lymphoma and walked away. There was no real thought about, I mean, he should have said, but even if that's the case, when we can treat it, I think that's a crucial thing, because actually aggressive lymphoma now, in some ways, is easier to treat often than the more chronic slow one, which is a whole nother story. But to actually give that hope at the same time, and to sort of, I mean, my father has had a blood cancer as well. And he got to a difficult point where me, him and the family, and that's often a way to do it, if you can see the family together with the patient, is quite good. We sat with my wife, him and me with a doctor, and the doctor said, look, you've now had two lots of chemotherapy. His was quite aggressive. This third lot of chemotherapy has only got a 30% chance of working, one in three chance that it will work. And then so my dad said, well, what if we do nothing? He said, well, then you will definitely die in just a few months. So that was a very blunt conversation, but there was still that element of hope. And so my dad chose to cling on to that 30%. Some people might not have taken it, which actually made me wonder whether that would have been the best way for every patient, because 30% doesn't sound very good. But actually, my dad did take that chance, which maybe not everyone would. He went through that chemo, and he's doing very well as a result. In fact, looks like he's cured of that particular blood cancer, because it's now 2 years since he had the stem cell. So, you know, that's, you know, this is a challenging area, and it's one that, you know, your own professional life and the professional norms will also influence it, as will your faith. And I guess it's all about being loving, speaking the truth in love, and giving hope, but not giving false hope.
From your experience, would you recommend any changes to medical training to support Yes. fellow professionals in similar situations? I mean, I guess both for handling dying patients or medical patients, Yes. but also, you know, being the patient oneself.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think bizarrely for me, one of the things that was the most helpful thing in my training to become a doctor was something that wasn't in my training to become a doctor, but I just decided to do. And that was to do some shifts as an auxiliary nurse, because there's something about the role of the doctor on a ward round, or even in a GP setting, where you're just in and out. You know, you swan onto the ward and you swan out. And even if you're the junior doctor, you go around and do your mini ward round. It's still, you know, in and out. You're not there at midnight unless there's an emergency happening and you're there to save someone's life. You don't see the patient being fed. You don't realize how disgusting the food sometimes is. You don't understand, you know, that the showers get blocked, or that, you know, I don't know, the what it's like to clean, and how humiliating it is to be naked in front of strangers, and all of these things you don't get to see. I mean, so yeah, I mean, you could argue every doctor should have to spend a night in a hospital as a fake patient. I remember my wife had to, as an OT, be wheeled around a shopping centre in a wheelchair, so she understood that a little bit. Maybe that's going too far. But doing some shifts, a good number of shifts as an auxiliary nurse or healthcare assistant, whatever we call those now, where you're actually more immersed in the culture of the ward, will definitely help to be a little bit more understanding of what it's like to be a part of the hospital community, the ward community, which often the doctors just flit in like a butterfly and flit out.
Yeah, we had to do the day with a nurse during our medical training as students, and it yeah. was, for you, it was incredibly enlightening for yeah. me, because you just can't walk away from the patient in the way that you do with
yeah,
the doctor.
No, exactly.
And say, well, I've got someone else to see. Did you ever ask the question, why me?
Sure.
And did you have any arguments with the Lord over this?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier about, you know, saying to God, why is it you don't seem to answer my prayers anymore? You know, that was one thing. But I think, yeah, you can feel a bit frustrated, you know, why, you know, I mean, everything was going so well with your career and your ministry and all the rest of it. So there's all of that. I did find a bit of an answer to the why me question. And that was where it talks about that, you know, God is the God of all comfort, who comforts us in our troubles, so that we can comfort others with the comfort we've given in any kind of trouble. And so I think for me, one of the crucial things was trying to get my focus off just myself and onto other people. And I guess that's where the blood cancer uncensored thing comes in, and also just other means of trying to care for other people, whether that's people with other big problems or indeed people with small problems, because sometimes they can feel embarrassed to tell you that they've got a problem because it feels like your cancer trumps their problem. So trying to sort of be compassionate yourself, you know, if you want to feel a friend, be a friend, as they say. So those kinds of things, I think. Yeah.
Well, as you were saying, do unto others was your final thought. And Henri Nouwen, I think it was, who talked about the wounded healer and saying how healers who have been wounded are far more effective because they know what it's like to be on the other side. Adrian, I'm afraid we've run out of time. I'm going to ask you one remaining question and keep you over slightly before we close. And that's that I know you've written, as I mentioned earlier, you've written a book on the resurrection. I remember as a student, you were very active in sharing your faith. You used to go down to Hyde Park Speaker's Corner and write tracts and so on. And so you've always been a keen evangelist. You mentioned the book you've written with your pastor as well. But how has your illness changed or affected or enhanced your belief and conviction in the resurrection? And how much has the resurrection been a feature of your hope during this time?
Yeah, well, without it, there is no hope, let's be honest. If Jesus was still dead, then we've got no hope beyond this world. And if you start to feel that your hope is ebbing away in this world because you're sick, then, you know, you would have no hope. So, yeah, for sure. I think, you know, the emphasis on the resurrection is really crucial for suffering because it gives us something to look forward to. And it also helps us remember that suffering has an end date. You know, if we just think of Jesus on the cross and identifying with our suffering and all of that, which is wonderful. And, you know, one of my favorite passages is about Jesus weeping at Lazarus's tomb. But, you know, it didn't stop there. He raised Lazarus from the dead and then he himself was raised. And that brings sort of power and a victory that, yeah, obviously, I'm not saying that I'm always like rah rah, but actually, you know, translate that rah rah. I don't know quite how you translate that. Sorry about that. But you know, it's there's an honesty and an earthiness necessary about it, that suffering is real, but a hope is coming.
Amen. And that's a great note to finish on. Well, thanks very much. We've been listening to Dr. Adrian Warnock, a psychiatrist, author, blogger. Talking about when the doctor becomes the patient and reflecting on his own experiences with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, CLL. It remains for me, Dr. Peter Saunders, to say thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you for Josh for managing the technicalities, for our four translators, most of all to Adrian for your honesty and sharing of your experiences, and to every one of you who have come along today. God bless you.